All right, you're listening to CFRO 102.7 FM. I'm going to put Gail Davidson on the line. We're trying to reach Dennis Edney as well, but we've left a message, and we'll try his number again in just a minute. Now let me just go over to Gail Davidson right now. All right, Gail, good morning.
Good morning, Charles.
Okay, so I do have a correct number for Dennis, and so what I'll do is I'll let you talk a little bit about the case right now that we're going to go. We're going to talk about the Omer Khadr case.
Okay.
And then I'll try to get back to Dennis. How's that?
All right. First of all, I'm just going to remind you who Dennis Edney is. Dennis Edney is the Canadian lawyer who acted for Omer Khadr since 2004, and Dennis and his Edmonton partner, Nathan Whitling, partner on the case, that is, another lawyer in Edmonton, obtained judgments from the Federal Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court of Canada that were precedent-setting cases, judgments that obliged the Harper regime to intervene to protect the rights of Omer Khadr, rights that were internationally protected rights that were being violated by the U.S., and the Harper regime didn't comply with any of those orders. Omer Khadr is the Canadian citizen who was arrested in July, taken prisoner, I should say, by the U.S. military in July 2002 in Afghanistan. He was held, first of all, in the infamous Afghanistan Air Base, Bagram Air Base prison, and then in October, the end of October 2002, he was transferred to the equally infamous Guantanamo Bay prison, where he was held mostly in solitary confinement for the following period of time. He's still there. In October of 2010, some 8 years and 3 months after he had been captured, Omer Khadr accepted a plea bargain from the U.S. whereby he pled guilty to 5 charges and received an agreed-upon sentence of 8 years in custody, with the first 8 additional years. He'd already been in prison more than 8 years, with the proviso, it had many provisos, the plea bargain, but one of the provisos, the reason I assume why Omer Khadr accepted it, was that he would serve one more year in a prison in the U.S., which is turning out to be Guantanamo Bay, and after which he could be transferred to Canada to serve the rest of his time.
Dennis, are you there?
I am, yes.
But Gail was just introducing the story, and if my memory serves me correctly, she was talking about some of the conditions that Omer Khadr faces with this arrangement that was made, and maybe you can just give us a straightforward update on how things fare for him.
How things are presently, or about the trial itself?
Well, why don't we start exactly today, where things are with him, where is he, how is he doing, what are his prospects of getting back to Canada? Those kinds of questions, I think, would be on minds of people who have been following this tortuous case over the years, and then maybe go back in time.
Oh, sure. Well, presently, Omer Khadr, at this particular moment, is in Camp 5, which is one of the 3 secret prisons in Guantanamo Bay. These are concrete buildings in the desert. These are different places of confinement than the cages that people or your viewers or your listeners have seen on TV. So he is in a solitary confinement, chained to the floor, and he's in the exact same situation that he was when many years ago I first went to Guantanamo Bay and I saw him as a young man, similarly in a lonely, windowless cell chained to the floor. So he's there and he's waiting to see what happens. There's been no information from the Americans or from Canada about when he is coming home or whether Canada will stand up to his agreement. So That's a brief background. However, it's our understanding and our anticipation that Omar Khadr will be back in Canada, possibly around about October. We have filed an application to the Canadian government under the Transfer of Prisoners Act, and confirming that we expect him to come home. So he's just sitting there waiting, and I understand that he is quite eager to see me because he wants to know, get some update on the status. And I intend to be in Guantanamo Bay at the very beginning of July. Information also from Guantanamo Bay is that Omar Khadr is not doing very well there. What you have to understand, he is in a unit in Camp 5 where the hunger strikers have been detained for years in these solitary cells. I think that's a story that takes too long to tell, but all I can say is that for over 6 years, hunger strikers have been locked away and force-fed for years and in that prison. And one of the smells that come from those cells emanates to Omar, and it makes him nauseous. So he's in pretty messy conditions environment right now.
All right, I'm going to let Gail join us. She's on the line with us now. Gail, do you want to just carry on this conversation with our guest?
Good morning, Dennis. Thank you for being on the show this morning. I'm overwhelmed by what you've said already. What I'd like to do for the rest of the time we have on the program, Dennis, is to just let you talk. But one of the things I wanted you to address was the recent review, if we can call it that, although it's just a faux process. It's all mockery. That occurred in the decision that was made last a week and a half ago, May 26, by the military review panel down there in Guantanamo Bay on the Omar Khadr case.
You're talking about the clemency application.
That's correct.
Well, the clemency application that was filed by the military defense lawyers, and which we received very late in the day. The defense lawyers had not provided copies to us, and when we reviewed the application, which was almost about a two-page letter to the convening authority asking that clemency be given to Omar Khadr, and we were shocked to read that one of the bases made by the military defense lawyers was that they had a deal in place with the prosecution, and that they were not to fully cross-examine the prosecution's main witness, Dr. Wellner. Well, we had never been told about that at all. We had no idea that there was a deal that was going to limit the cross-examination of Dr. Wellner. And even when I was asked by the military defense to speak to Omar and try to persuade him, and did successfully persuade him to enter into a plea bargain, I hadn't been provided, obviously, with full information to allow Omar Khadr to make an informed decision. So I was quite annoyed at that. And so when I contacted the military defense lawyers as to what is going on here, what is this about, I then received an email from a law firm on behalf of military defense counsel threatening a defamation lawsuit, so should I pursue that line of inquiry. And of course I continue to do so. And the reason I tell you that backdrop is because it leads to the whole trial itself. When I came out of that trial, after all those years of fighting for Omar, I was ashamed. I was ashamed of myself, and I was ashamed of the process. And I've said this to many people, and of course people say to me, well, look at the work you have done. Why should you feel ashamed? Well, I can say that Omar Khadr, the last thing he wanted to do was to take a plea bargain, because he understood, as he verbalized to me, that as soon as he entered the plea of guilty, the Canadian public would see him as a terrorist. who see him as someone who has killed someone, but he says that's not true. But the choices that he faced were life imprisonment in places such as Guantanamo Bay, or get out, as I tried to persuade him, and get on with his life, and tell the Canadian, show the Canadian public the real you. But I'd also promised Omar that in the sentencing process, that I had arranged to bring all types of international witnesses to speak on his behalf. David Crane, for example, who is the chief prosecutor for the Sierra Leone trials for child soldiers, was prepared to come. Radhika from the UN, talking about youths, was prepared to come, and many others. On top of that, I said to Omar Carroll, we have our own psychiatrists and psychologists. We've been paid a lot of money to assess you, and they will go on the stand, and they will be able to rehabilitate your character that will be challenged by the prosecution. But that didn't happen. I had spent the summer arranging for witnesses. I flew to Guantanamo Bay preparing for the trial. And then I persuaded Omar to take a guilty plea so that he would be out in a few years. And then I focused on the sentencing hearing. And all I received from the same office as the military team was silence. At the end of the day, none of our witnesses were called. And on the eve of calling our psychiatrist and our psychologist, they chose not to go on the stand. And so Omar Khadr was eviscerated from any form of defense whatsoever in that trial. In fact, after all those years of preparing for trial, Omar Khadr's trial came down to two witnesses. One was a teacher that I had Omar, who'd had assisted Omar in educating himself. A teacher who I had led, Singh, who, well-intentioned, did a great job in providing me materials to take to Omar to help him develop himself. She had never met him, never spoken to him, and so she had very little that she could say on behalf of Omar Khadr. And then there was a soldier who had talked about every so often running into Omar Khadr in the camps. This is a soldier present in Afghanistan. And he talked about what a pleasant young man he was. That was the sole defense effort to rehabilitate Omar Khadr. And then, it's a long story. It takes too long to tell to your readers, but then there was a deal that took place also that I was aware of, and I challenged and got nowhere with it, was that when Omar Khadr agreed to plead guilty, the military defense also did a deal with the prosecution that would limit the amount of witnesses that he could call on his behalf. The prosecution, it was agreed, would call between 10 and 12 witnesses, and our military defense lawyers agreed that we could call two witnesses. It was just a farce. And so I left there not a very happy camper. I felt I let Omar Khadr down, and he had such trust in me. And then, of course, as a matter of formality, the second part of the process after the sentencing is arranged and taken and sentencing is completed, is that you make a formal application for clemency. Well, that took months before this 2-3-page letter was sent to the convening authority by our military defense team. And when, as I said, when I read that, I also indicated there was was Omar limited in the manner I just described, but the defense team itself would not challenge this witness, Wellner. And so I recall sitting in the trial, if you want to call it that, and prior to trial, I kept offering to help in challenging this Wellner. For example, I had transcripts provided to me by various lawyers in different parts of the world of this, who had challenged Dr. Wellner. I provided that to the team. But at the end of the day, a defense lawyer stood up and went through a cursory set of questions that lasted about 15 minutes, whereas the prosecution had Wellner on the stand for 2 days. And our defense, then the defense lawyers stopped questioning him. And I remember being absolutely shocked. Couldn't believe this. But of course, what I hadn't understood was that it was a side deal that hadn't been explained to me that they would not challenge Wellner. And even though now I have to say to you that the prosecution denied they had this deal in place with the military defense. But my military team didn't tell us that. The actions indicate that's the truth. And it was just a bloody sham.
Thank you, Dennis. Hello?
Yeah, you're there, Gail. You're on the air.
I think we've come to the end of our time, Dennis. Thank you for this chilling summary. I would like to follow this up in greater detail on another occasion. So we hope to be able to speak to you again soon. Of course, one of the concerns of the people who've been trying to advocate for some justice for Omar Khadr over the years, one of our concerns at this time is whether or not the Harper government will honor the plea bargain agreement, and whether Omar Khadr will indeed come back to Canada, and what fate will await him once he arrives back in Canada.
Yeah, thank you both, Gail and Dennis. And I have to say, Dennis, maybe it's not appropriate or not, but I you know, when I hear this story, I reflect back on this being the 30th anniversary of the death of Bobby Sands, who starved himself to death in the H Block cells just to make a point against that kind of wretched, mean, violent, malicious judicial system that's put in place by these big imperial powers. In that case, it was Britain, of course, and in this case, the United States of America. It seems there's just no dealing with these people, you know. They are so bent on their cruelty and on their revenge that justice is just not a word that meets their ears.
Well, and I really think that the Omar Khadr case is a very, very important case, because globally and domestically, because the entire case is emblematic of a shift globally from global affairs, a movement to have global affairs dominated by a rights system, towards a global system that's dominated by military power. And so the Khadr case is emblematic of the success of that movement, and also of Canada's involvement in that movement as a handmaiden to the United States, because we have to remember that Canada didn't just refuse to intervene when it was proven that Omar Khadr's internationally protected rights, including his right to freedom for torture, were being violated by the U.S., but Canada participated. They participated in torturing Omar Khadr, for example, and that fact has been confirmed by the Federal Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada on several occasions. Canada was the only Western nation who refused to use any diplomatic efforts, make any diplomatic efforts to have their nationals released. Australia, Belgium, Denmark, France, Russia, Spain, Germany, Sweden, and the UK all secured the release and repatriation, not just of their nationals, but their residents. The UK secured the release of their residents.
And there's another aspect to that, Gail.
Yes?
So we can't leave the Canadian public out of that.
Okay, Dennis, what do you have to say about the Canadian public?
The Canadian public is not the society that I came here as I'd understood to be when I came. It's a complacent society.
Yes.
I have been in 3 Supreme Courts on Omar Khadr, the U.S. Supreme Court, and twice before the Canadian Supreme Court. And I have been successful. I have not lost a case against the Canadian government yet. And yet politics obviously trumps the rule of law. And because, as you said, Harper, and not only Harper, but the Liberal government itself.
Exactly.
They've all been complicit in abandoning a Canadian citizen. And yet, I have talked about Omar Khadr for years. I have struggled for him for years. I have been vocal about him for years. And yet, the Canadian public doesn't... I don't know what it takes for the Canadian public to get angry.
Yes.
Particularly when you have a government that was criticized, the Canadian government, for being... criticized for being complicit in torture and the abandonment of the Geneva Conventions for Omar Khadr.
Yes.
All I can say, Dennis, and I have to cut this now, is that the story's not over yet. Don't give up on the Canadian public yet. This may be a long story. Let's see how it unfolds. Let's keep fighting the good fight. And Dennis, congratulations to you. You know, obviously, there are Canadians like Gail and I out here who are with you in this 100%, but you're right, the full voice of the Canadian people hasn't spoken yet on this sufficiently well, and I'm sure our listeners are taking note of that. Take care, both of you.
Yes, and thank you, Dennis. And not only did Canada abandon Khadr, but they abandoned the law.
All right, Gail, yes. Take care. Right. Thanks,
thank
bye-bye, you.
You
guys. Take care.
Thank you, Dennis.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.